Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how perceiving yourself as less physically active than peers is linked to a shorter lifespan. New research out of Stanford University. Then aging Americans enjoy longer life, better health when avoiding three risk factors. I'll tell you what those three risk factors are today. New research from the University of Michigan. And a study finds that day-to-day experiences affect our awareness of aging and then our mood. North Carolina State University. And a groundbreaking study shows cannabis oil, the very oil we were talking about yesterday, if you remember, well, let's not assume everyone listening today heard yesterday's program, but we had one of our scholars in residence, Richard Gout, came in to talk about how a top Florida legislator doesn't want cannabis in any way legalized, not even medical cannabis. But it was what he said. He said specifically that there was no science at all supporting any medical or health benefits from cannabis. Fine, that was his point of view. But remember, it's not just a lay citizen saying that. It's a person who has power within a legislature to keep other legislature members from voting on something that impacts a lot of sick people. So we presented information that just one part, one fraction of the cannabis issue has 22,500 scientific studies in the government's own official medical PubMed database and also through our Library of Medicine. Now, those are the resources that are used by governmental agencies and governmental experts to come to some determination of what is qualified science. So you have to ask, how is it that there could be 22,000 studies? And he said there's not one study. And so I want to add one more, 22,501. Today, from the Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, a study at Michigan State University shows that cannabis can help stop HIV from becoming AIDS. That's major. That should be headlines. What do you want to bet you won't find this anywhere in the media? I couldn't this morning, and I looked. So we'll share it. Now, later today, we will put up on our website a list of some of the most important scientific studies proving the benefit of cannabis oil, what are called the cannabinoids, for seizures, for brain cancer, for lung cancer, for autism, for Parkinson's. There's a whole wide variety of conditions that it helps with. So then it's about the human failing. Now, why, we don't know, and I'm not going to speculate. I have no idea why this man could get up and in a position of authority say there's no science when there is tens of thousands of studies. But he said it. And in fact, I'm going to ask our engineer, I'm not in studio today. In fact, for the next couple of days, I'll be filming outside of the area. But I want to just play that in a few minutes again, just so you see how insidious it is. Now, also today, I'm going to play a clip of an interview between Tucker Carlson and Max Blumenthal. Now, Max is an extremely competent investigative journalist. He does really good work, and he's one of the few journalists who've had the courage to interview people within the Palestinian territories and the Israelis to see what's behind all that. Most won't touch that. That's a third rail. We will. But it doesn't have to do with Israel today. It has to do with what's wrong with this whole Russia discussion. Also, there was a 21-person indictment, quote, for conspiracy in Dallas of a massive hospital fraud. It's only 2 minutes long. I'll play you the news clip on it and then show you why that's happening every day all across America. And also, we have an anti-vaccine doctor, the top, even more powerful than Paul Offit. And that is Dr. Gerberding, who was the head of the CDC, who left the CDC to go work in her position at Merck, making millions of dollars. We know that because when she sold her stock, part of her stock, she made about $3 million. And she's really pro, but she's trying to convince other doctors why they should really get tough on any patient who questions vaccine safety or efficacy. And then my guest in the second part of our program is Professor Robert Thurman, possibly America's leading academic expert on Buddhism. And Dr. Thurman will be on to talk about the lies and the propaganda of China doing something good and modern and beneficial in Tibet. And of course, if you want to listen to this program Monday to Friday, noon to 1, live, and you can't be near your radio or a computer by a telephone or your laptop, let me give you a phone number that you can call and always reach the show. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. But let's say you're just working, you're traveling, you can't listen at all, but tonight you want to. Then you can go to the archives and you can download up to 5 shows with each call. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Let's begin. But first, we're going to hear from that Florida representative. For those of you who didn't hear, it's only 24 seconds long. And this is a man who is not equivocating. He's absolutely determined to let you know there's no science behind marijuana.
I don't believe that medical marijuana exists. I just don't. Some of us may believe that medical marijuana exists, but in point of fact, you will find no convincing scientific evidence that proves that point.
What you're hearing now with this music is you see a young child in a massive seizure. And that child in the seizure, the mother gives the child one single container, a small syringe, probably 5 cc's, of cannabis oil. And I mean immediately, the kid calms completely down. It can turn off seizures. Do you realize how many millions of Americans have seizures? And this is something that's natural because the brain has natural cannabinoid receptors in it. So he says there's no science. We found 22,500 studies in the government's own database. We're publishing some of those today, at least 50 today, from published in peer-reviewed journals done at major institutions and proving cannabis works. My suggestion is this. Even if you just start with what we have up online, it completely puts the lie to what he is saying. We have a lot of people in Florida, and if you, listening from Florida, could download and send to that legislator, as well as to every member, including the governor of Florida, showing the entire body of scientific literature shows cannabis is extremely beneficial, non-toxic, and helping overcome conditions that medicine cannot deal with, then it might help pass that legislation. So that's our call to action for today. But I'm going to add this in. I'm going to quote from the Journal of Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome. This is from Michigan State University today. Quote, with so many studies coming out on the numerous ways medical cannabis can treat health ailments, some of us may have become slightly numb to the wonders being revealed about this beneficial plant. But a new study just published in the Journal of Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome might change that. Researchers have found that the THC, the main psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, can help prevent HIV from becoming AIDS, according to the abstract published online in the National Institutes of Health. By the way, let me digress. The National Institutes of Health is the number one overall medical scientific body in America. Everything else is below it. the National Cancer Institute, National Institutes on Aging, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the CDC, the FDA, are all a part of the National Institutes of Health. So it's the National Institutes of Health that did the research. And then it goes in and discusses this. And quote, patients with HIV in the United States routinely use cannabinoid-based therapies to combat the side effects of HIV infection, antiretroviral therapy. However, cannabinoids, by the way, that's the oil, not what you would smoke. Cannabinoids, including A and then THC, are well-characterized immunosuppressants. Here we report that THC suppressed secretion of IFNA by PDC from both healthy and HIV plus donors through a mechanism involving impaired, and then it goes interferon regulatory factor. That's very scientific. But much of this is Greek to those who do not understand medical terms, but the results show this. It's stunning. HIV patients taking cannabis have likely helped prevent their condition from turning into full-blown AIDS. Now, that will open the door for medical cannabis to be used for the dual purpose of treating side effects and preventing the disease progression. And I think that's very, very positive. Now, I'm also going to ask our engineers to pull up a clip from our archives of the man who won the Nobel Prize for isolating HIV, Professor Luc Montagnier, though Robert Gallo is given credit as the American discoverer of HIV. In point of fact, that is not the case. He was using a strain on loan from the Pasteur Institute at the time, and we happen to have his original study from the National Cancer Institute. And that original study was done by Dr. Popovic in his, who ran his lab. He was over trying to interest the French the HIV antibody test before he'd even published his first article on the isolation of HIV. In any case, we have to thank the late phenomenal investigative journalist, Janine Roberts. She was the one who told the world about blood diamonds. She was the first. She was the first to do major stories for BBC or Channel 4 in the United Kingdom about Aboriginal children being sold. She did dozens of important groundbreaking stories, but she also managed to get a hold of the relative, immediate blood relative, of the person who had the original article that was published in Science. And you have to have it in front of you to appreciate it. It's just scribbled, all with Robert Gallo's notes, because he came back. And here was an article going to go to Science. But it didn't show that there was a unique HIV virus. It did not show you could see it. To the contrary, the head of the National Cancer Institute, the head of their electron microscope division, said that all he could find was cellular debris. So therefore, there was no discovery. There was no unique retrovirus. But Gallo changed all that. And he got that article published in Science magazine. Now, you may not be aware of this, but hundreds, actually thousands of scientists, including Nobel Prize winners in the area of AIDS, professors of virology, were outraged. And so a group of the most distinguished ones signed a petition to Science magazine to retract the articles because they were false. Science refused to retract them. And it's understandable, because if you retract that article by Gallo, then you're going to have to start from scratch and not the science we've been using since then. Anyhow, if this particular clip, I don't know if they can find it, but if they can't, the clip is from a film, and a very good film called, I think it's called House of Numbers. And in there, the director asked Luc Montagnier, who actually won the Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV virus, by himself. Now, that's never been done before, where you have two people who supposedly discover something, but only one is given credit. That's never happened before. For example, Madame Curie and her husband both won the Nobel Prize for their work on uranium. but not just one. In any case, he says, can you prevent the HIV infection? He said, yes. He said, if you have the HIV infection, can you reverse it or get it out of the body? And he said, yes. Now, it wasn't because of AZT, which killed, I believe, hundreds of thousands of people, but rather it was with antioxidants, clean water, and good food. And he didn't qualify it. He didn't say, plus the drugs. That's what he said. So he was asked the question again. And again, he answered very specifically. So now imagine what happens when you're sick, real illnesses, 30 real illnesses that we call AIDS, and you change your diet radically, you build up your immune system with all the known ingredients that will help your immune system, and you get some medical intervention like high-dose vitamin C and high-dose aqua vitamin A and ozone and homeopathic zeolites, and suddenly, after a period of 16 months, you go HIV negative. You were HIV positive. You have pneumocystis, you don't have it. You have all these conditions, you no longer have it. So that's some of the stuff that people should be aware of. So I'm glad to see that cannabis can now be added. By the way, for those in the field, it's been used for a long time. I'm glad they did this research, but it's been used for a long time. It's just been used quietly because it's not legal in every state, and people actually had to go to the state in order to get it. In any case, we don't have the clip right at our disposal, but when I get it, they'll keep looking for it. It's Professor Luc Montagnier. It's the clip we're getting. Next study. This is from North Carolina State University, and it talks about our day-to-day experiences and how they affect our aging. Here's what it says, quote, a study of older adults finds an individual's awareness of aging is not as static as previously thought, and that day-to-day experiences and one's attitudes towards aging can affect an individual's awareness of age-related change and how that awareness affects one's mood. Quote, people tend to have an overall attitude towards aging, good or bad, but we wanted to know whether their awareness of their own aging fluctuated over time in response to their everyday experiences. And then they found out it did. Now, what's this mean in lay language? Why should you be interested in this? It's relatively simple. Let's say that you're aging, but you have an active life, and you're busy with family, friends, career, hobbies, cultural activities, studying, and you're not paying a lot of attention to the slow process of aging. Now, you're not intentionally trying to do anything to age yourself, but the consequences of eating the white bread and the white pastas and the white rice and the fried chicken and the barbecued ribs and the beer on Sunday, watching the ball games and the pizza for the comfort foods and the quick foods, over time, your body is prematurely aged. Your cells are inflamed. You have about 10,000 gene alterations per cell per day. That means every cell in your body is attacked about 10,000 times a day. And that is important. So, here's what you should know. The day that you wake up and you look in the mirror and you go, whoa, and you look down at your knees and you got creepy skin, that little kind of loose skin, or you look at your arms when you hold them out and you got loose skin and bagginess, and your hairline is receding, and your jowliness is happening more than what you had in the past. Now, what happens is one of two things. That's what they're saying here. Either A, you start to realize, okay, I'm aging. This is normal, and it's just going to continue, and this is as young as I'm ever going to look right now, looking in the mirror. This is as healthy as I'm ever going to be, and you just kind of go with that. Or you take a different approach. You think, I don't like how I look. I don't like how I feel. I don't have the energy I once had. I don't have the strength I once had. I can't go out and do the things I used to do with ease. Now I struggle with that. And immediately that changes your perception from positive for the day to negative. Now you're just looking at yourself as waiting to die. Now, I don't care if you're 50 years old or 40 years old. It's all negative if your disposition is negative towards aging. And I'm suggesting a third approach, approach that allows you to say, okay, I see what I'm looking at. What I'm looking at in the mirror right now is not anything having to do today, but has everything to do with all those choices I made leading up till today. Now, I can't change any of the things I've done in my life. No one can. But what I can do is I can change how I want to feel about myself, and I can start to change as much as humanly possible. I'm going to get off all the sodas and start drinking fresh apple juice and tomato juice and vegetable juices and watermelon and lemon juice. I'm not going to eat any more French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, and pizzas. I'm going to eat healthy food in its place. I'm not going to overeat. I'm going to eat what my body actually requires. I'm going to educate myself about my needs. I'm going to exercise 6 days a week. I'm going to deal with stress. I'll do some yoga, meditation. I'll get to spend more time with my pets and friends and family, the things that are important to me. Now, that means you now go back to positive. Not just positive, but very positive. And very positive, you turn your DNA full throttle into healing. I mean, you just push it to the metal. And that's how we get a quantum healing. Quantum healing is not measured. It is not itty bitty tiny. Oh, I don't know. Can I give up? Oh, I don't know. Oh my God, if I have to give up my French fries, I might as well pull out my teeth without Novocaine. No, I'm going to give it up. I'm going to give it up and I'm going to do everything good. Now you're into a completely different state of being. You actually start to heal, repair, and reverse your aging process. So, they had two parts of the equation correct, and I just added a third. By the way, I have a clip from the man who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR, polymerase chain reaction, Dr. Kerry Mullis, but I'm not going to play that today. We have, my engineers have found that, but I will play that next week. You can watch it on YouTube, the whole 18 minutes. But I will, over the next couple of days, we will find Professor Luc Montagnier's piece and play it for you, because it's really, if that was played on the mainstream media, it would completely change the entire war on AIDS. They would start using all the therapies that those of us who've been working with people with AIDS have been using and give it legitimacy. University of Michigan, aging Americans enjoy longer life, better health when avoiding three risk factors. Here are the three risk factors according to these researchers. And here's what they say. Quote, research from the University of Michigan School of Public Health shows that people of fairly normal weight who never smoked and drank have a life expectancy at age 50 that is 7 years longer than the average American. How about that? That means that instead of living, let's say, to the normal life expectancy of 78, that you could live 7 years longer. All right, you could be up there 85. Now, that's without taking supplements. That does not include exercise, nor does it include detoxification or rejuvenation, in which case you could add 20 years onto your life expectancy. So if you're 70 now, you could easily live to be 90. If you're 80, you could live to be 100. So that's the good news. Now, of course, you have to look at the other side of that. If you've been smoking or drinking socially and you've been overweight, you're going to die sooner. So just remember, it's all waiting for us. There's an old, there's an old Middle Eastern story. And it's about a young boy and his father, and they're in their garden. And the father looks up as this figure approaches and looks terrified and runs and runs and runs to the next town and hides out in a church. And the young boy doesn't know what's going on, and this figure approaches, and it's the figure of Father Death. And Father Death is shaking his head side to side, holding his chin. The little boy says, what's wrong? And Death says, well, I wasn't supposed to meet your father until tomorrow in a church in the next village. We just don't appreciate that everything in life has an expiration date. So appreciate the opportunities you have today. Because there's going to be a day when you wish you had opportunities, but they're gone. And so are a lot of the people in your life. And finally, from Stanford University, published in Health Psychology, would you say that you're physically more active or less active or about equally active as other people your age? Your answer might be linked to your risk of premature death decades from now, no matter how physically active you are. And that's the research. Quote, our findings fall in line with a growing body of research suggesting that our mindsets, in this case beliefs about how much exercise we are getting relative to others, can play a crucial role in our health. So in lay language, what am I talking about? If you look in the mirror and you don't see yourself as vitally fit, if you don't see the abs, if you don't see the muscle, then you're not going to live as long. Because you're going to think, gee whiz, all those other people out there who are healthier, more fit, you know, and then that means you are already turning off the DNA to the healing process and you're going to have a shorter lifespan. This is Stanford University research. So you want to be as fit as you can, but don't make the mistake of looking at other people and say, if I'm not as fit as them, well, then something's wrong with me, and get into a negative mindset, because that mindset can kill you. That's the latest on health and healing. We're halfway through our program. I'm broadcasting today. You can watch this program in its entirety on Monday on YouTube and the health and nutrition segment on Facebook at that same time. But I'm not filming today. I'm just recording. But Monday through Thursday, I film also. And we have a lot of people downloading it off Facebook and watching it each week. And hopefully they're getting healthy in the process. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Tomorrow, 3 o'clock till probably somewhere between 5 and 6, I'm going to be doing a very comprehensive webinar on perimenopause, which is premenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, how to save your life, how to prevent heart attacks and strokes, how to overcome night sweats and hot flashes, how to get your energy back, lose weight, regain your hair, your eyebrows, your muscle mass, your hormones rebalanced. It'll be a very comprehensive show. You want to join me? Because my weekends now are packed, so this is the last one I'm going to be able to do for a while. Just go to GaryNall.com and it'll show you how to get there. Now, I want to play you a segment here that, and then we're going to have a discussion on it. And then after that, then we'll go to our guest, Dr. Robert Thurman. But this is a discussion between Max Blumenthal and Carlson Tucker. And by the way, some of the things Carlson Tucker talks about, I think good for him, because you don't hear these debates on most television or radio. But on some issues, he goes way off the deep end. Like last night, he called O.J. Simpson a murderer. We may not like the outcome of what happened in the original murder trial, but there's an awful lot of information that never got to the lay public, even professionals. One of my closest friends in this world, who lived in California, who was very influential within the California Hollywood community, did his own private research and told me the story of his researchers, and I can assure you that, no, I can't assure you, because my friend's deceased. I'll just say that I believe that if you don't like the fact that O.J. was not convicted, you ask yourself how much of that might be racial. And if you would agree with the jury system, then why did you not agree with the jury system? The jury was there every day. But Carlson could have said, I disagree with the jury system. That's fine. He has a right to say that. But he called him a murderer. And unless you have the proof of that, then you've way stepped over the line of being objective there, Carlson. And that's unfortunate because on a lot of issues, you play at least within the boundaries. Here he's playing within the boundaries with Max Blumenthal. And then you're going to ask, why didn't Max Blumenthal get invited on all the other liberal programs to discuss this issue? Please listen in.
Had a relaxing weekend because our political class here in Washington did not. Instead of barbecuing with their children, maybe taking some time to solve the many problems this country faces, they were back on television fretting about the Russian takeover of America.
What do the Russians have politically, financially, or and any personally on Donald Trump that he fawns over Putin? The American people have a right to know.
I do not want to see our democracy undermined by having the President of the United States colluding and his officials colluding with Russia.
This love of Putin that this president is showing and this defense of Putin that this president has done and all of the other things that I've just alluded to is unseemly.
We can also say that Donald Trump Jr., what he did was a threat to our democracy and borderline treason.
Borderline treason. Well, Max Blumenthal is an author, a journalist, and a lifelong man of the left. Yet he's become skeptical of the Russian collusion narrative, which he has called destructive and dangerous. Last month, Blumenthal took a camera to an anti-Russia protest on the National Mall here in Washington to find out what the people who were there actually knew about the topic. Here's part of the conversation, an amazing conversation he had with progressive Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin.
But you said that Roger Stone hosted a show on RT.
Roger Stone hosted a series on the Russia propaganda network.
Do you believe that we need...
Roger Stone didn't host a show on RT.
You think he's never been on an RT?
But he didn't host a show.
Okay, but look, you know, you can go after over any picayune details you want, but I don't see why it would be in your interest to support an autocratic authoritarian government which is jailing journalists and fighting against freedom around the world.
I think we should tell the people the truth.
The person behind all this... that is called Guccifer, G-U-C-C-I-F-E-R 2.0. There's new information as of today based upon an analysis, a meta-analysis has emerged from a document published by the independent research known as a Forensicator, which suggests that the files eventually published by Guccifer 2.0 were initially downloaded by a person with physical access to a computer possibly connected to the internal DNC network, and the person most likely used a USB drive to copy the information. Now, this groundbreaking new analysis destroys the Russian hacking narrative and calls for the actions of the DNC to be reviewed. So here's what we do have at this moment. That an individual working with inside the DNC, who is a Bernie Trump supporter, saw how he was being dealt with in illegally by the DNC and its top people, and therefore he finally had enough. He downloaded documents. He met with the former ambassador to the United Kingdom, who has verified this, by the way, and received these documents in a thumb drive near the university, George Washington University. He, in turn, got them to WikiLeaks, and he then put them out. So when he was asked, when Julian Assange was asked, did any of this information come from Russia or Vladimir Putin? He said no. And he had never met with Putin, and this was not Russian. So the media is not interviewing that former ambassador. They're not looking at this information because it would destroy their entire narrative. But here's another thing, and then we're going to go to our guest that I'm concerned about. look at all the major issues today. Next week, I'm going to deal with the whole destruction of our educational system, how all of the major subsidies go to the major polluters, of how the military-industrial complex, about 400,000 contractors in Washington, D.C. and Virginia, control virtually our entire military expenditures, and it's all for their own use and need. It has nothing really to do with defending of America. That both Obamacare and anything that would take its place currently are simply extensions of the profit centers for big ag, big insurance, and a big hospital. No effort is being made for universal health care, including by Bernie Sanders. No effort to forgive student debt. No effort to deindustrialize our efforts around the world and refocus our efforts at bringing jobs back to America. Nothing about the corrupt taxation system where your major corporations make the most profit, pay no taxes whatsoever. And instead of having one flat tax, let's say whether it's 15 or 20% that they cannot get out of, which would bring us over $1 trillion extra dollars, no redeeming any of the false parts of the medical industrial system, our public health system, which there's no health in our public health system. So neither Democrats or Republicans are addressing any of these issues with any solutions. So they have nothing to offer. It's only third-party efforts, independents outside that system that are making any effort at global warming, reduction, health of Americans improving, health of our economy improving, getting people out of debt. That's not coming from the government or private industry. So they're just distracting, smoke and mirrors, this whole nonsense with Russia. But it's not nonsense that the Clinton corporate Democrats and the liberals that support them would love to see Israel nuke Iran and start a third world war, because we'd be committed to going on the side of Israel. And why is that not just a speculative idea? Because here's what we do know. The United States and I documented. I gave you the cities or the countries. I gave you the dates last week of how many countries the United States had destabilized their elections. So here's all this talk about how, you know, the Russians impacted our election, and we are on record. It's a matter of historical record that the United States has engaged in regime change or meddling in other countries' democratic elections over 81 times with devastating impacts. And if you doubt me, I have the list. Italy, 1948. Iran, 1953. Guatemala, 1954. From 1955 to 1970, the CIA supported Tibetan insurgencies to destabilize China. We're going to talk about it in a few minutes. But repeatedly in 1959, U.S. and CIA and the Pentagon attempt to overthrow Castro's regime. Vietnam in 63, the Democratic Republic of the Congo from 60 to 65, Iraq 60 to 63, Chile 70 to 73, Turkey 1980, Poland 1980, Haiti 1986, the intelligence support for the repressive terrorist Duvalier clan after Baby Doc was ousted by the people and Aristide was elected. We didn't want that, so we tried to undo Aristide. The U.S. has always been the enemy of liberation theology and its proponents in Latin America and the Caribbean. We supported the death squads. We trained the death squads at the School of the Americas. That's a matter of historical fact. In Nicaragua, 1980, the U.S. and the CIA intervened in the Marxist-Sandinista effort with Daniel Ortega. In Czechoslovakia, the U.S. involved with Havel's Velvet Revolution against the Communist Party. So we don't think about the consequences of war. We don't think about the consequences of military overreach. The other day, I gave a list of over 40 people that I believe, including the guest on right now, of how we should be putting people who know how to talk peace, have talked peace, are peaceful in intent, are also diplomatic, and are there to try to heal wounds that have been caused by the militarist. And both the Democrat and Republic establishment have been pure, unadulterated militarists for decades. And the media supporting them, both MSNBC and CNN, and even Democracy Now. These are militarists. And look who's funds in the Paul George Soros. And instead, why don't we have a single person, not one single person can you name, not one in the last 50 years who has represented America in peace, who's really a peaceful person, a spiritual person who understands what it means to be the victim of American and French and Italian and English and other countries overreached militarily into a country. So the people who we should be sending in never even get mentioned. So we are the perpetrators, and yet we have no courage within the media to call out these crimes and misdemeanors against humanity. That said, let's now go to our guest who is standing by. And he is, I mentioned earlier, he is Professor Robert Thurman. He holds the J. Zhang Kapa Robert Thurman Chair of Indo-Tibetan Studies at Columbia University. He's the president of the Tibet House, U.S. and in New York City, which is dedicated to preserving Tibetan civilization. And New York Times has hailed Robert as the leading American expert on Tibetan Buddhism. And he is also an author. He's co-written and written, including Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's nice to be with you.
There was a recent article published on the left news site Global Research out of the University of Ottawa in Montreal that argues that the lives of Tibetans are far better today after the Chinese invasion and occupation of the country starting in October 1950. And I have a great deal of respect for Global Research and its founder, Professor Michael Chovsky-Desky. And they always post my investigative reports, but I couldn't help but question the validity of this article's claims. My own independent research into the article's author, Caleb Maupin, gives no indication that he himself has actually visited Tibet to observe conditions himself. His specialty is primarily Latin America and Middle East. In brief summary, the article claims that rather than the People's Republic of China destroying Tibetan cultures and traditions, it has enhanced it. And the author praises how the Chinese brought modern implements into the Lost Kingdom, how it has constructed a high-speed railway that will bring economic prosperity and reduce poverty, and how the Chinese government is building massive public housing for thousands of Tibetans and providing water and electricity, and also how the tourist industry is booming and improving Tibetan lives. Clearly, what comes to my mind is that the metrics being used to assess the benefits of the Chinese occupation are that of modern capitalism and nothing more. And the author is relying solely upon economic progress, material wealth, to determine the well-being of Tibetans. And of course, nothing was stated in the article about the massive exploitation of minerals and natural resources and deforestation and rising pollution happening in Tibet at this very moment as we speak. So you've been to Tibet many times over the course of decades, and you've also had a constant line of communication to facts on the ground. So take your time and reply to this particular article. The floor is yours.
Well, that's the usual Chinese propaganda, that they have improved things so much in Tibet. But actually, the Tibetans are so much more worse off than they ever were under the Chinese occupation, with over a million killed unnecessarily, some by famines, but famines occasioned by Chinese mismanagement of the high-altitude environment of Tibet, which they don't know how to live on. And others by outright, like prison camps, gulags, you know, like thought reform, class upheaval, et cetera, communization and collectivization of nomads, which doesn't work. And in general, they ruined the place, but they have made it a beachhead for Chinese colonization. All of the money they've invested and all the housing they talk about building and all this and all that has to do with providing jobs for the Chinese settlers that they've tried to send up there. The railway, for example, was to extract resources more efficiently and to move their military up there more quickly, as they did when the Tibetans protested, you know, plateau-wide in 2008 and 7 about the Chinese oppression. And so it's just completely swallowing that kind of report, just completely swallows Chinese propaganda. As you've noticed, you know, the Chinese can go almost to any country, and maybe they'll succeed now with Trump finally in America, and block the visa of Tibetans or the Dalai Lama going for a visit somewhere, South Africa, or he was close to Nelson Mandela. He was a friend of his, but he was blocked from visiting there when he wanted to go to Tutu's birthday when Tutu invited him. And Chinese just, you know, have such clout because of people thinking they're going to sell stuff to China or Chinese investing in their country, that it's become really quite difficult to have a true view of what the situation is in Tibet. But what the situation in Tibet is it shows that the Chinese themselves are quite capable of being colonialist, imperialist, you know, genocidal, etc. And this is why China can't solve its Hong Kong problem or its Taiwan problem, and why its other neighbors, like in the, you know, Vietnam, all of the ones around, even the Burmese finally had second thoughts and kicked them back out as they were taking over Burma a while back. And it makes them all nervous because China, you know, has the pretense that we're a socialist and we're liberating everybody, but it's far from the case, actually. But, you know, your long chronicle, Gary, of the misdeeds of America, I think, is very appropriate. And the misdeeds of all of these military-industrial countries operating in this completely ecologically destructive manner and keeping their power over their own people by purporting to have a military enemy, someone, this is a unit. Now it's a universal pattern, you know. And Trump, as you say, is kind of like the... He's almost a relief in the sense that he openly demonstrates total lack of ethics, total greed, total self-serving, no interest whatsoever in keeping his word in any way whatsoever, you know, and therefore lying with just joyful impunity. And in a way, that's what they've been doing in a more gentlemanly and more hidden manner all along. So in that sense, finally, the American people might, maybe will wake up and demand... We have an actual government here, you know, that cares for the, that serves its people, you know, rather than a few wealthy backers, you know, the way it is. What is the saying? Conserve their contributors instead of their constituents, you know, which is what, unfortunately, our government has deteriorated into. So China's no different, is my point. Some leftist types will point to China and try to claim, oh, they're the ones who are doing it right. Oh, Stalin went wrong, but they're doing a great job. And that's just, there's an expose of all of that, how the journalists, the leftist journalists who were used to praise Russia up through World War II, like mad, you know, as an antidote to Western capitalists, whatever, laissez-faire capitalism. Then when Stalin turned out to be too disreputable to continue that, they shifted to Mao and they made him into the dream-realizing hero. And all of that is false. And then the Chinese themselves have shown in the last two or three decades how they are just as capitalist and just as oligarchic as everyone else, you know. So the case of Tibet is Tibet is like a Standing Rock resistance movement, like Standing Rock of the native people here who were so badly genocided, but who are still there because no genocide ever gets to be complete, really. And so they are still standing there and trying to save their local ecosystem and save us all from the wrecking the planetary ecosystem, which we are doing. And the we there is everyone, all the oligarchic, capitalist, materialist-minded people, they're all doing it. So we're all equally guilty, and we all equally have to take responsibility to fix it. The Dalai Lama has a wonderful concept he calls universal responsibility, where everybody has to kind of stand up as individuals and take responsibility for every situation and not point fingers at others, and then associate with like-minded ones and then try to fix this system, this broken planetary system. So anyway, I'm your fan, Gary.
I appreciate your insights there. One last question. When I look at a country like Bhutan, which has rejected free market capitalism and Western corporate interests and basically closed its doors from what we regard as Western materialist values, we find its population remains one of the happiest and most satisfied in the world. And this is according to a lot of international research, including that conducted by the United Nations. And I'm of the belief that if Tibet had never been invaded and occupied for 67 years, it would have naturally developed into one of the happiest, most content nations in the world. And the Dalai Lama, although in exile, has always been interested in modern science and the best Western modern concepts that it can offer, but he has also seen astutely the downside of modern living and how it can enslave the mind in frivolous pursuits and delusions. So I don't think Tibet would be a medieval feudal land, as some might think, if the Chinese didn't annex the country. And knowing the Dalai Lama for so many years as a personal friend, what might Tibet be today if it had never been invaded and was permitted to evolve on its own during these past six decades?
If they had not invaded and they had respected the long-term relationship between Chinese rulers and Central Asian rulers and Nepali ones, et cetera, all Tibet's neighbors, of supporting Tibetan spirituality and Tibetan culture and so on, then the Dalai Lama, who his predecessor, the 13th Dalai Lama, was the first one to really travel outside because he was invaded by the British Imperium out of India. And he saw that Tibet needed to modernize its infrastructure. It actually had not been feudal. Tibet had not already been feudal for about 350 years. Tibet had no military budget and didn't invade anybody for 800 or 1,000 years. Tibet had monasticism and university, and the monasticism in Buddhist case is not just sitting there repenting your sins. It's also learning and writing and doing art and philosophy and inner science of the mind and this kind of thing. Also medical science. A lot of the monks were doctors and things. Herbal medicine is very sophisticated. And what he would have done would be modernized Tibet for the Tibetans, not for Chinese colonists after crushing all the Tibetans. And, you know, like that thing in that study that said they've been building housing for Tibetans. It's so funny, because what they did was they went out and they took the nomads' yaks and sheep and goats, which were their livelihood. They shot all of them or made Chinese burgers out of them, and they moved by force those nomad families into little roadside settlements where they gave them like a few concrete slabs, which they charged them money for, and a little motorbike or something, and then destroyed actually their way of life. And that's like the U.S. put the Indians on reservations and shot all the buffalo so they couldn't go out and hunt and live in their normal way 100 years earlier or 120 years earlier, 150 years earlier. So it's a complete genocide going on there, actually, simply. And, yeah, they were trying to develop it for China. But the great thing and the amusing thing, if it wasn't so tragic, is that it's been proven by Chinese, good Chinese doctors and researchers, that a sea-level person cannot live comfortably year-round at 15,000 feet. It's not possible. They get chronic mountain sickness, which leads to heart disease in males, and it leads to miscarriages in females because there's only 47% of the oxygen they would have at sea level, and the placenta will not form around an embryo. And that is why Tibet was empty of Chinese, who've always had many millions more than the Tibetans for thousands of years. And that's why it has been that way. And just putting one railroad going up there to extract more borax and more uranium and more lithium and more whatever it is not going to bring the air up there that the Chinese need to settle there. So if they continue to exterminate the Tibetans, there'll be no one to occupy the Tibetan plateau for them, except short-cycle, you know, short-term military rotating occupants who can manage for a few months or a year or two if they get a few months downtime in the lower altitude without getting sick. So it's just one of the, it's a typical environmental catastrophe. Also, Tibet is the water tower of all of Asia, like people have on top of buildings in New York, you know, that run the cooling systems. All the rivers, the Yangtze, the Yellow River, the Mekong River, the Salween, Irrawaddy, Indus, Ganges, Brahmaputra, all the great rivers from China to Pakistan all come from Tibetan glaciers, which are as big a mass of ice as the Arctic, and they are melting by the Chinese mismanagement and deforestation and desertification of steppes and so on. And they are melting at a rate three or four times faster than global warming would have them melt, according to Chinese's own geological people, you know, not just Westerners. And so it's a catastrophe for all of Asia, actually, that is being done in Tibet, and that's a simple fact. That is a historical fact, you know. So politics aside, you know, if the Dalai Lama had been allowed to modernize with the help from all directions, you know, the British would have helped, the Indians, Nehru would have helped, Mao could have helped, the Russians could have helped via Mongolia and so on, and Tibet would be a real paradise. Now, for example, they also said tourism is booming. Foreign tourism is not booming, just Chinese internal tourism. And it's a complete colonial system, and very sad, actually. And destructive to the environment. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Robert, we're out of time, but I thank you for being here as a voice of conscience and a voice of peace. And the book is Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. Robert Thurman's website.
That we all disarm mutually, you know, and I elaborated a slogan from his teaching, which is we shift from mad to mud. Mad being mutually assured destruction, and mud meaning mutual unilateral disarmament.
Good. I hadn't heard that before. I fully support it. He is a person of peace, as are you. Thank you very much, Robert Thurman, for being on. It's Robert Thurman, BobThurman.com. I'm Gary Nall. Sorry, we're in a little over. We're out of time. Have a nice day, everyone. Stay tuned for U-Tree's lead.